Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome back to an all new, brand new, sexy new, recording new continued success podcast with me,
eloquent Justin, as always.
The current managing editor of The Good Fight, Justin Clue, that's me, and the former managing editor of The Good Fight, current full-time staff member of Yahoo Sports, Liz Rocher. We host this podcast. It's about the Phillies in the past and currently. Hello, Liz.
Hello, my first continued success episode as not the managing editor.
I too didn't think I'd remember to introduce it differently, but I've done it.
Yeah.
And so this is therefore a new era of success for this podcast where the introduction goes smoothly. Everyone who has a job is said to have the correct job. And even the names are said in the right order. I remember a couple of times I referred to you as Riz Locher. Those were dark days for the art of the podcast, certainly. But yes, on this podcast, a member of the Good Fight podcast family, if you're listening to this, you most likely listen to Hit and Season with John Stolness, as well as myself and Liz Rocher. I was away this past Sunday, but you and John held a dandy of a mailbag session, which you guys answered a ton of very important, very crucial questions from our listeners and from Phillies fans and from our Patreon subscribers, to whom we are ever so grateful. You, of course, can go over to the Hit and Season Patreon and subscribe for $5, for $10. I think you can just throw us a dollar. You have that option. And you can get access to all kinds of bonus content, whether it's John talking about Phillies history or previewing some of these playoff series or some of these extra dirty innings that we do, where we talk about the worst or most hilarious or most obscure innings in Phillies history and break them down in greater detail than they could ever deserve. So we are very, very much encourage you to do that, because I think if you're listening to this, it's probably something you would consider worth the $5. But this is continued success, where we talk about anything we want, basically, as regarding the Phillies, while also chronicling the stories of the 2008 and 1993 Phillies, both of whom had significant anniversaries this year. And Liz, we're finally getting to the parts of the stories that people probably remember very clearly.
Yes, finally. We're there. Thank you for staying with us.
All season long, and then a couple of times where we just didn't talk about it at all. But all season long, we've been chronicling these two teams and their journeys and talking about the significant milestones from their seasons and tried to dig up some anecdotes that maybe you hadn't heard or had forgotten about from 93 and 08. Talked a lot about Lenny Dykstra's ass.
I was just going to mention that of all the episodes we've done this season, like, the one that sticks out to me the most is literally the one where we talked about Lenny Dykstra getting injected in his ass with steroids
brazenly and without shame.
And like, literally, he's being injected and he's like, no, you're not seeing anything, it's fine.
Marched his nude ass defiantly past the general manager, who was like, hey man, I can't legally ask if you're on steroids, but what's going on with that ass?
Lenny Dykstra probably going to jail.
And he just winked, and now he's going to prison. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, a lot of good times. A lot of good times that season. We got to relive all of them. But yeah, like I said, now we're getting to the part of the story where both teams begin the playoff push. Well, not the playoff push, the playoffs themselves. Last week, we actually talked about games one and two of the NLDS in 2008. We talked about Shane Victorino's Grand Slam and the CC Sabathia, the Brewers acquiring CC Sabathia for that, you know, for a playoff game specifically. And game one of that series as well, that Sabathia did not start. That I think we talked about how people often forget that Sabathia, that wasn't game one. I forgot that wasn't game one. But the 1993 Phillies, they didn't play an NLDS because that's just not how that worked back then. They clinched the NL East and then had to play the champions of the only other National League division, the West, which was the Braves, which, again, makes no sense that the Atlanta Braves were the West division, but the Philadelphia Phillies were in the East. That's, you know, whatever. But Liz, just we're talking about the playoffs. The Phillies have infamously spent 39 days in first place this season. They spent, you could back up that math and even say they've spent 39 days in first place since 2012.
That how would many be days, pretty much true.
I mean, it's exactly true. It's even alphabetically, when you list the teams and nobody's played a game yet, the Phillies are not in first place. So that's got to be true. Mm-hmm. But Liz, so they spent 39 days in first place this year. I'm sure you don't have a exact answer to this, but I'm going to ask, how many days of this season, or we'll even count since 2012, like we did for the actual first place total, how many days had you felt like the Phillies were going to be a playoff team? How many days did you wake up in bed and go like, you know what? The Phillies are going to the playoffs. And it wasn't even like a epiphany. It was just like, oh yeah, this team's, they're going to playoffs. Like how many days do you think, was it more than 39? Was it less?
Oh, that's a question. Because at no point did I ever really let myself feel that the 2018 Phillies were for real, which is the most depressing thing I've ever said. Maybe not ever.
No, it's not. I listened to you on other podcasts, and what did you say last week? That I was wrong to hope.
I was just going to say. As a Phillies fan, as a Philadelphia sports fan, I've been taught it's wrong to hope. I mean, I would say maybe a handful, maybe five, maybe 10, where, you know, what's sad is that after that four-game sweep of the Marlins at the beginning of August was probably when I was at my peak of, yeah, I mean, they made, I woke up and thought, yeah, they're going to the playoffs. They may have traded for some players that are probably as useful as a single shoe when you need a pair, in fact, to walk. But, you know, they're going. They just swept the Marlins. It's all great. And then right down to the bottom of the ocean, they sunk.
So, yeah, I guess throughout the year, I mean, I'm not going to say that this is like also a private thing. It's not like we were spouting from the heavens each time we thought, I think this team could be a playoff team. Before you publicly express your Phillies opinions, I let mine pass through a filter of, you know, realistic, you try to make it. OK, I'm not a volcano of emotion right now. You try to make sure you curb the more dramatic aspects of your feelings before putting a microphone in front of your face. But I mean, I would say that I was expecting the Phillies to get into first place. So I would say more than 39 days this season did I think that the Phillies were going to the playoffs. I think that's certainly true.
I'm proud of you.
Especially when they were like 8-9 games over 500 was like, this is already different, and then
they're
double
digits.
They're
never going to be just 500 again.
Certainly not below.
They couldn't even get to 500 for my final season. Fuck the Phillies, man. The entire last 2 weeks when I knew about the job, I thought, God, could they do it? I mean, they're sinking really fast. It looks like they suck and barely remember how to play baseball, but it would be great if they could just hit even just be at 500 for my final season. It would feel like a triumph.
Just at least to close the loop, you know, narratively. That, nope. You know that I say that, that's I think what people are so mad about. Like they're mad. I mean, that's some people. I think there's a subconscious desire for this all to make sense. Remember how much people loved how they could say, oh, you don't think the Phillies have gotten worse every year since 2008? Well, check this out. They won the World Series, then they lost the World Series, then they lost in the LCS, then they lost in the NLDS. They didn't make the playoffs, finished below 500, finished in last place. Arrest my case. And that was like asinine because
then they budged a horse.
You unravel that. You help the horse off the ground. And then you unravel that by saying, yeah, but the 2011 team won 102 games, which is, I think, the most in Phillies franchise history. I don't know what the hell I know it's, but it's a fun little, like, it's not symmetrical, but it's easily trackable. It's a fun little stat to get to say. And it's narratively, I'm going to say satisfying just because, satisfying in the way that it follows the same pattern and that they got a little worse and they got a little worse and they got a little worse and then they were in last place. And I think that's what people are so mad about with this team, partially, that subconsciously this doesn't make sense narratively. It would have made so much sense for them to be bad in 2012 and then, oh, we can't figure it out. Oh, okay, we got to get rid of the old guard. Okay, well, now the guys we got for the old guard are getting better and they're developing and they're doing all these cool stuff in the minors. And okay, now all those guys are going to get their chance. Okay, now we've installed this new front office that's employing all these more modern applications of statistics and analytics. And okay, here's this crazy new manager from out of town and nobody knows who he is. And he's stepping off the train and he's dropping his suitcase at his feet and taking like a deep breath and looking around the train platform. And it's all this going to come together and everything. And how about it? And look at them go, oh, they had a really bad three-game start to the series where everything went totally wrong. But then they turned it around. They clawed their way into first place. They were in first place for over a month. And then that, look, the 2008 crew is in town for alumni weekend and the Phillies are going to play the Marlins for four games. And, oh, man, Michael Franco just hit that walk-off home run and everybody's going crazy. And they swept the Marlins in four games and the 2008 guys were here. And it was this whole crazy thing. And there was a stat circulating at that time that was like, I don't know. It was comparing something the 2008 team did to the 2018 team. They like both had the same record at some point or something like that. It just seemed like the story was narratively satisfying. Mm-hmm. And for the team to just sack out and just loudly fart over the last 2 months of their calendar and put themselves in such a weird place where it was like, okay, what are we supposed to think about this? There are like no good players on the team and everyone hates the manager now. It's narratively, this doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. The arc was going down. It was coming back up and then it abruptly just fell off again. And I think subconsciously that's just, people don't know what to do with that. It doesn't make sense narratively. And I think that's how most people digest sports. It's certainly how I digest it. So I don't know. I think that's something that's got a lot of people really riled up right now, or did before the Phillies stopped being a talking point because it's also football season and playoff baseball. Now they're kind of buried under a couple other news cycles. But I don't know. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, narrative, excuse me, everyone looks, I mean, narratives are what drives the playoffs. You know, it's team that has never won, team that hasn't won in 108 years, you know, team that was terrible last year and is suddenly good. You know, everyone loves narratives and they're satisfying and they fit into our brains because it's what we've been sort of trained to look at, to look for, to find comforting. We watch movies. Excuse me, I'm dying. This is what's happening.
Talking about the 2018 Phillies has given Liz a throat condition.
I'm dying.
Be patient. Don't talk about it. Don't address it. Just let her go.
Now, of course, I forgot what I was saying.
Terrific. That's kind of what that conversation topic deserves, to be honest. Talking about how comforting narratives are.
Oh, no, I remember. Yes, I'm so sorry. People like, you know, we watch television and movies, which are narratives just in a box. It's in a half hour, it's in an hour, it's in 2 hours. It's a beginning, middle, and end. You know, there are peaks and valleys, but it's all comforting. You know, we read books. Those are all just contained narratives, and people look for that because it's what our entertainment is. And sports are entertainment. So people were looking to the Phillies to sort of fulfill, to check off all those narrative boxes. Like, yep, they were terrible last year. Yep, things have all changed. They have a new manager. Check, check, check. And now they get to the end of the season and sucking so hard for a month and a half was not part of that.
Exactly. And it's just added such a weird epilogue to the 2018 story. But we've wasted enough breath on 2018, Liz. It's about 15 minutes already. We've talked about a team I promised we weren't going to talk about as much a couple episodes ago, because this is such a crazy, intense, entertaining part of both the 2008 and 1993 seasons. And we're going to talk about the 1993 season this time, since we focused solely on 2008 last time. 1993, like I said, there was no divisional round of the playoffs. The Phillies just jumped right in with the Braves, the team that was, pretty much seemed ready to win the World Series from day one. They were the team everybody assumed was going to make the most noise and create the most problems for people. Liz, I don't know. I mean, do you remember or know anything about what the NL West playoff picture was like back in 1993, when that's what the division the Braves were in?
No, actually, I don't. I was 10, and I have a computer that is connected to the internet. I could have looked.
Oh, interesting.
But I like it when you tell me. I like it when you share all this information with me. But yeah, I was 10, and I only remember watching approximately 20 to 25 seconds of the game, though I probably watched more. I remember sort of being sat in front of it, because it's what was, on at the house, watching a World Series game. When we get to the World Series, I'll, talk about that, I'm sure. But yeah, so I don't remember any of this.
Well, what's wild and kind of sucks about the Braves is that we think about them from this era where they won 14 divisional titles in a row. The Bobby Cox, Chipper Jones, like that whole era of Braves baseball, that all those guys were kind of there the whole time. But in 1993, they were already this dominant team that in the offseason, they signed Greg Maddux, the reigning Cy Young Award winner, which kind of solidified that they were going to be the fucking team, because they were good. I mean, they were just a tremendous team that got the best pitcher on the market, and it was like, all right, they'd already been to the World Series both times in 91 and 92, lost both times to the Twins in 91 and the Braves in 92, or the Blue Jays in 92. They kind of looked pretty well set up to destroy the NL West and the NL in general, and they pretty much did with 104 wins. Now, the problem was, in the Phillies were fending off the Expos. For a time, they were fending off the Cardinals. They were an annoying team. And obviously, we talked about that huge series with the Expos the Phillies played, where it was a success that they managed not to get swept in Montreal and wound up with 97 wins, which was enough to finish three games ahead of the Expos and win the NL East. But in the West, the Braves were fighting off a team with a much slimmer margin of error. The Braves were fighting off the Giants at the time, who were a team that no one had really expected to be as successful as they were. They finished with 103 wins as opposed to the Braves' 104. Liz, just imagine for a second, two teams in the same division finishing with over 100 wins. First of all, that's an entertaining race to watch. Also scary that they're both in the same division. And for anybody else who had to play them, just ask the Padres that year, who finished with 61 wins, 43 games, 43 games out of first place.
You could also ask the 2018 Orioles, Blue Jays, or Rays.
Exactly. Because I was going to tie that in, because now we're looking at an ALCS with the two best teams from the American League record wise in 2018. Both of which had, correct me if I'm wrong, over 100 wins. The Red Sox had 108. Indeed. And I guess talking about, yeah, exactly, the Yankees also had 100 wins this season, but the Astros had 103. I mean, that's a lot of winning. The other day I tweeted something about the Red Sox winning 108 out of 162 games, and I was like, I never put those numbers right next to each other, and that is a terrible. They didn't lose. They did not lose all season. 108 out of 162 wins? That's absurd. Yes. 103 and 104, not too much different. The thing is, can you imagine being a team or rooting for a team that wins 103 games and does not even go to the playoffs for even a little bit?
No, like that might kill me.
I mean, you want to talk about narratively unsatisfying. Good Lord. When you're the team that's like not supposed to be here and is combating with the Braves were fighting a version of the NL West version of the 1993 Phillies all season and then lost to a different version of that team in the playoffs. It's that sucks though. I mean, what an unbelievable turn of events that the scrappy upstart in the NL West, you know, if someone told the Giants that season, you're going to win 103. Not only are you going to sign the other big free agent catch on the market, Barry Bonds, and have him contribute to you winning 103 games, you'd be like, oh, sweet, the Giants are going to the playoffs this year. No. I mean, this Giants team was in danger of having to move out of the Bay Area. Like, that's where they were. Apparently, back then, St. Petersburg was a big very interested in becoming a town with a new MLB franchise, and obviously they succeeded when Tampa, when the Rays became a team. But
and everything all worked out for Tampa perfectly ever since.
Well, I mean, just listen to this because I was unaware of this. If this has been going, this was going on since 1984. St. Pete tried to get the Twins in 1984. They tried to get the A's in 1985. They tried to get the White Sox in 88, the Rangers in 88, the Mariners in 91, and then the Giants in 92. I mean, they were trying very, very difficult or very, very hard to get one of these major league teams to move to the St. Pete area, which again, yes, looking at Florida baseball attendance is pretty hysterical, and they tried so hard. And now, you know, nobody wants to go to watch a baseball game in a giant toilet. So, yeah, that was the Giants were kind of in that position. And it was a fight to the end. Obviously, the Braves finished one game ahead of the Giants in the NL West. But yeah, no, I mean, we can talk more about what it would be like to be the fan. I mean, no one has any sympathy for Yankees fans, but they did win 100 games this season. They also got to go to the playoffs. They won the wild card game. They played in a playoff series. So they got out of that round of games this year, which was a bunch of win or go home games with game 163 and then the wild card game. So that's not even like, you wouldn't feel bad for them in general, but even that isn't even really comparable to what Giants fans must have gone through that season, watching their team win 103 out of 162 games and then go home. I don't know. I don't know what would compare to that as in sports fandom.
I have no idea if there's even anything that could compare to that. I mean, it's significant because there's so many games in baseball. Like, I guess, you know, a team could win, you know, out of all their games, they could go, you know, they could a great record, an insane record in basketball or football is important. And it's annoying if they don't go to the playoffs, but it's not like you just spent, you know, 6 friggin' months playing games almost every single day. You know, it's a lot different for other sports. So I don't know if there's really anything like it, at least in sports. Can you think of anything? I can't think of anything.
No, I mean, that's just kind of like, I don't know, it's like watching the bus you were trying to catch roll away with, like, your hand almost through the door. Like it's a tough feeling of frustration, except instead of, you know, except you've been watching that bus come for like 6 months. My friend, I don't know why all my baseball metaphors have to do with buses. My friend once said baseball is like waiting for a bus, but when it gets there, it explodes. And it's a pretty accurate and good characterization of baseball, but it is about a bus. I don't know. It's strange. That NL West race was interesting. The Braves did not do great at the beginning of the season. They had this phenomenal pitching staff. But as every Phillies fan knows, you can have the best pitching staff on earth, but if your offense isn't coming through, then, you know, you can't blame guys for not being able to make one or two runs stand up every night, let alone all the games where your offense gets shut out by, like, a back-end starter. So the Braves were struggling for that reason, and the Giants, they were not. Barry Bonds went off as he would, you know, he was a member of the Pirates until 1992, so he just switched divisions, and he went off in the NL West. Everybody, you know, that was a lot of fun for the Giants to watch, and of course they had Matt Williams. He was doing well. Robbie Thompson was another player on the Giants who he was hitting 300, and that was, you know, a fun surprise. Those are the guys you need. When your bad players are hitting like 280, 300, that's when you can probably guess like, oh, we have a shot at the playoffs, because those are the guys you need to come through and have those weird anomaly good seasons to make the playoffs. And then the Giants had pitchers named John Burkett and Bill Swift, who I'm not super familiar with, you know, certainly not as familiar as I am with Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, you know, Steve Avery, John Smoltz, like all those Braves pitchers that we know so well. But that doesn't matter. The Giants were getting the pitching appearances they needed. They were had a super powered offense with a surprise acquisition. Their new owner, or their owner, was a grocery tycoon who somehow managed to put enough money in to swoon Barry Bonds and get him to come to San Francisco. That paid off huge. The Braves, offensively, didn't get Bonds. They managed to get Fred McGriff. We just mentioned how bad the Padres looked that season. Part of that was because they were in the middle. They were selling everything must go. They got rid of Gary Sheffield and Fred McGriff. And it's to the point that Padres fans filed a class action lawsuit against the team. they felt that they had made management promise not to trade away the team stars. And, you know, of course they were doing that. So the Braves got Fred McGriff. And you know, the way the story goes, the Braves weren't hitting. And the middle of the season arrives. It was July 20th. The Braves, I don't have the 1993 standings in front of me, but obviously the Braves had not been performing as promised when you think about the team being considered such a powerhouse early on. But on July 20th, they a funny thing happened at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium when the press box exploded.
What?
Yeah, that's right. No, it caught fire, certainly. The press box caught on fire, spread to the point that about 1,000 seats, a couple of radio booths were gone.
Oh, my gosh.
Destroyed. But, however, it was written that the fire really lit a spark under the Atlanta offense. Again, narratives. And they, from that point forward, the offense started coming through. That night, Fred McGriff, he ignited a comeback win against the Cardinals. The Braves won 8-5, and Atlanta just got hot. And at that exact same time, the Giants started cooling off. And it culminated in this four-game series in August between the two teams at Candlestick Park, a hilarious place to play baseball. And the Braves swept the Giants in four games, and it was first place was theirs. And the Giants just continued to go downward until they managed to pull out of their downward spiral and land in a first place tie with the Braves until the season's final weekend. And of course, you know, that ended in the Braves making the playoffs. But it was quite a race. I hadn't heard the story about the stadium catching on fire. That seemed like it played a major role narratively.
Yes, it did.
But yeah, no, in the final, after that series in San Francisco that started, it was late August. They played the Giants again in Atlanta. They took 2 out of 3 from them then. And then the Braves, I mean, they looked unstoppable in September. Their September record was 19-8. And that was after going, 19-9 in July, 19-7 in August, and 19-8 in September. I don't know how good your simple math skills are, but that's a pretty amazing second half when you're losing only single digit games in each of the months. And then in October, they went 3-0 with the rest of the regular season. Like if you're going to be the hottest team in baseball, obviously you're going to take the second half as a time to do so over the first half, because damn, the Braves. Yeah, they couldn't lose. It was a bad place for the Phillies to find themselves in going into the playoffs, obviously facing one of the roasting hot teams in baseball. But the 1993 NLCS Game 1, Liz, the Veterans Stadium looked like a stained napkin from the sky. You know, that beautiful AstroTurf as the Goodyear blimp flew overhead and all the hallmarks of early 90s sporting events broadcast on.
I was going to say AstroTurf.
National television.
Goodyear blimp.
And it doesn't end there.
Was the Noid there? Was the Noid present?
I'm sure the Noid. Part of watching the broadcast of this game, the joy that we're going to get into, are the commercials that occur between.
Old, I don't know what it is. Man, you want to get me started on old commercials? I'm a crazy person because I fucking love them. I love old commercials. They just tickle a nostalgic part of my brain that, you know, is inaccessible any other way. Like I have YouTube lists and lists and lists full of like commercials from Nickelodeon in the early 90s and Nick at Night and stuff like that.
Oh my God. Well, I thought that would appeal to you, and that is going to be an aspect of all of our coverage of this 1993 NLCS and World Series. We'll try to get through games 1 and 2 in today's episode. And yes, welcome back to Veterans Stadium with a sellout crowd. I don't know how many people, packed 70,000 people in there? 62,000.
Oh my God.
62,000 people were at Veterans Stadium.
I forgot that it's that enormous.
Yeah, it was huge. It was a place where I think Philadelphia designed it. So they're like, look, if we have to trap a huge amount of people in here and just keep them there for like a long time, just because it's Philadelphia and we just need like 62,000 people out of the way, we need a facility that can house those people. And they did. They successfully did that. Liz, the NLCS itself was only 25 years old at this point. And CBS Sports introduced game one of this series using the Jurassic Park theme song with a bunch of images of you know, past league championship series. Jurassic Park, obviously coming out in 1993, so that was a slick little entertainment synergy move for CBS to use. Bringing in this game, Pat O'Brien, what was it, Entertainment Tonight? Pat O'Brien is mostly known for hosting.
Yeah, I think that's it. Pat O'Brien, the only thing I can hear when I hear his name is that horrible voicemail message he left for Paris Hilton.
Yeah,
remember that?
That's same Pat O'Brien, yeah. Introducing the 1993 NLCS. Liz, we got to talk about, we're going to get into more broadcasting stuff, but first, anytime the Philadelphia Phillies or any Philadelphia sports team is a part of a national sporting event, the drinking games you can put together based on the cliches spouted by national media.
Cheesesteak and hockey?
It's so boring. It's so disappointing. I hate that I'm even entertained by it anymore. I don't know how much of a Mitch Albom fan you are. I think that he is terrible.
Yeah, he's bad.
I mean, everyone knows who Mitch Albom is at this point. But Mitch Albom was still waxing poetically, reminding people that, hey, I was 13 and I worked as a program vendor at Veterans Stadium. And for some reason, the book More Than Beards, Bellies, and Biceps by Rob Gordon and Tom Burgoyne uses a passage from the Detroit Free Press that Mitch Albom was writing for at the time. I'm going to read you this. Mitch Albom said the team characteristics of the Phillies were that they like to eat bottle caps, roll in the mud, and beat each other up.
What the hell
does that mean? They like to eat bottle caps? I know what he's going for there, but why can't you just say the stuff that is happening rather than like, I'm going to make up stuff that conveys the feeling of the real stuff. Like, I get that that's writing, but this is also like, come on, man. It's a baseball game. Like, people know who the Phillies were doing ridiculous enough shit that you don't need to say, oh, they were like Billy Goats eating out of the garbage. Mitch Albom. Please go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, now that you've brought up Mitch Albom and I'm like, I've heard his name recently, it's because he just released a new book. In 2003, he wrote a book called The Five People You Meet in Heaven, which you should not read and just throw directly into the garbage disposal. But he just released a new book called The Next Person You Meet in Heaven. Now, I pulled up Mitch Albom, and the top stories are from 1 and 2 days ago. Huffington Post, Mitch Albom is still running shockingly gory heaven porn. And the next one from the Washington Post, reading The Next Person You Meet in Heaven is hell.
I like the heaven porn one better. That's way more accurate. Hang on. It gets more ridiculous, Liz. During this summation of the 1993 NLCS, Mitch Albom, who, again, couldn't stop talking about how he was a program vendor when he was 13 at the vet, claims that one night when he was 13, he stuck a wad of gum under his seat. And last year, which I guess in 1992, he's saying, he went back for a visit, reached down, and found the gum was still there, Liz. This is something a grown man claimed and wanted people to believe. Gum. He recognized his gum from decades ago. Also, you're a program vendor. What are you doing?
That did not.
What are you doing sitting on your ass, you lazy little 13-year-old, trying to use that as a blue collar, oh, don't worry, old people, I'm with you kind of thing. Like, no, what are you sitting down watching the game, you lazy ass 13-year-old? And also, none of this happened. Also, why mention it? Like, oh, I left garbage in Veterans Stadium. I left mouth garbage under my seat, and it was still there. Therefore, the Phillies.
You are not special. Everyone who ever visited Veterans Stadium and left mouth garbage there.
It's mostly mouth garbage. The other things he goes on to mention are that Mitch Williams has his nickname engraved on his bowling ball. Lenny Dykstra drools tobacco. Darren Dalton is married to a former penthouse pet. These are all things that... these are truer things, which again is you could rely on facts to point out how ridiculous and idiotic some members of this team were. These are things that it's just he feels so proud to have discovered these things. And like he's not doing a lot of work here. He's just telling an audience that hasn't been following the Phillies all year things that anyone who's followed the Phillies all year already knows. So he's not like doing a good job, is I guess my point, even when he's saying something that's true. That's pretty typical, like, Mitch Albom, now I can't stop using the word heaven porn, but that kind of style of, like, Americana bullshit where he's like, oh, and the gum was still there, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's what you expect from him. And that's not the end of the ridiculous, I mean, again, we're talking about cliches when Phillies teams are playing in national events. It took 2 minutes of the CBS Sports broadcast of the game one of the NLCS to mention that this is, quote, a blue collar town.
Blah, blah.
I mean, how much more blue?
We get it.
How much more blue collar do you think Philadelphia is than? I mean, obviously there's slight differences, but like how much every big city has a blue collar population. Like that's how cities work because people like that are cleaning things and making sure stuff works and doing actual jobs.
Everyone calls Philadelphia blue collar because the movie Rocky exists.
Yeah, that's kind of it.
Everyone. That's really it. I mean, it's such an arbitrary distinction. Mostly, it's a blue-collar town because of its size and its inferiority complex towards almost every other city in the country, at least definitely towards New York, at least probably just East Coast cities. But, you know, they call it no one calls New York a blue-collar city because it's enormous and has huge buildings, and Philadelphia is a little bit more understated and it's smaller. But also, Rocky was a major, huge, giant, enormous movie, and everyone thinks that is what Philadelphia is always.
Yeah, that like New York's rich and
it's
has
just
class.
It's a dude in a way too tight sweatsuit running around as people throw fish and talk in other languages at his face.
That's blue collar if I've ever heard it. My grandfather used to go down to the Italian market and get fish thrown at him every morning, and everyone said thank you for your contributions to the functionality of our city. Yeah,
I mean, what Philadelphian in the 70s didn't know, a hard luck boxer who was, you know, dating a secretly pretty woman who had an alcoholic brother who smacked her around? Everybody
did that.
All
of my older male relatives are boxers with horrendous brain damage. What else can you do at that point? They all, they all just kind of sit in the same room all day and, you know, get fish thrown at them. Because that's what they remember. You know, that's what they're used to. And that's what used to be what this country was about. People with brain damage getting garbage thrown at them. That's blue collar. Anyway.
I really thought you were going to say all of my adult male relatives are actually Polly.
Yeah, the ones that aren't boxers just beat up meat hanging from hooks and meat lockers. Like that's their favorite. That's their go-to release. The broadcasters not only kept mentioning this is a blue-collar town, they also used the line, the once beleaguered Phillies are the beloved Phillies. So that was a fun little phrase to hear said into a microphone. I think people just loved the idea. Phillies were not supposed to be there. And, you know, that's very true. That's very true. And if we talked about narratives, the narrative for this series was, 100%. The Phillies are this upstart piece of crap team full of guys who be the guys hitting on your sister at the bar. And the Braves are like, we are stoic baseball, the elite baseball players of this era, blah, blah, blah. So that makes total sense. And of course, the national media is going to run with that. At this point, it's been 10 years since 1983, which was such a, to hear that mentioned offhandedly, oh, it's been 10 years since the Phillies were in a World Series. And you were like, oh my God, it doesn't even sound that long, but okay. Yeah. Wow. But what dominated sports talk of the day, Michael Jordan had just thrown out the first pitch at the White Sox Blue Jays ALCS in Chicago. And people were wondering if it was the last sports-related thing he was going to do in Chicago. This was dominating the conversation. You could tell Pat O'Brien didn't really want to focus on it, but CBS Sports made him ask Deion Sanders, Lenny Dykstra, and Darren Dalton before the game, what they think about Michael Jordan. And can you imagine them coming up to you, getting ready to play in game one of your first playoff game, in some cases ever for some of these guys. And Pat O'Brien's like, hey, what's your take on Michael Jordan? I literally just need sound bites to fill out the beginning of this broadcast. And they all just gave him best in the game, but I really admire him, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. And you're just like, oh my God. And then they cut back to Pat O'Brien sitting in a chair, and he's just like, I'm trying to remember exactly what he says, but it's just like, we're spoiled. We'll miss him. Let's move on. And he goes right back into talking about baseball. So that was the sports conversation of the day. And then we get to our first series of commercials, Liz, which were, and I think you're going to love this, FedEx package tracking being offered on a floppy disk, a commercial in which someone who sent a room full of businessmen something is checking to see if they got it. And they're like, oh, we didn't get it. But she's able to see by putting, a very large piece of plastic into a large plastic slot that a series of very gray, vague numbers express that, no, they actually did get that package this morning. And boy, don't they feel foolish afterwards. So the pinnacle of technology being advertised. Liz, a show called South of Sunset was being heavily promoted. This is a show about a private detective agency that opens up just one block south of Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. They got
my favorite.
A gritty.
I love commercials for failed television shows.
Ugh. Not only did this TV show not make it into, the general conversation about TV that occasionally happens, this is a show about a gritty detective, his smart-mouthed assistant, and his sassy receptionist. And they're shoving each other, and they're sniping at each other during these promotions. And this show is there's commercials for this show all throughout the NLCS on CBS. South of Sunset aired for one episode and was pulled from the CBS lineup after one single broadcast.
If you had asked me, that's what I thought you were going to ask me to guess how many episodes. That was my guess. Just one.
Just that single after all that. So it was probably in so many people's heads at that point. Nah, one episode. Execs didn't like it. Trash can. So poor South of Sunset. And lastly, we got a Tim Allen commercial for Builders Square. Hey, bleh. 90s Tim Allen. Who doesn't love remembering that guy? The hair, the mugging for the camera. His commercial was about how helpful people at Builders Square are. And they just keep popping out of the shelves and disturbing him in the bathroom to be helpful to him. And oh, man, what a wacky time to be going to the bathroom in a hardware store. The 90s. Whew. Never know who you're going to run into in there. So anyway, Back to the game. Tim McCarver suggested that the Phillies outscore the Braves, possibly by scores of 11-7 or 8-5, in order to win the game.
Are you serious?
That happened. He suggested winning scores for the Phillies to try.
He actually suggested scores for them to quote unquote try.
I think,
you know, it's like he never played baseball.
It's like he's just discovering it for the first time minutes before the cameras started rolling.
I do not miss that. I do not miss him at all. I know that there are shitty broadcasters on TV right now, and I know that, you know, I talk about them on the internet, but seriously, I would take any of them. Even Matt Vasgersian, who is aggressively horrible at his job. I would take... He's fucking terrible. If he calls another prospect the property of another team, I'm going to burst through my television and strangle his stupid face.
It's a lot of the same words. And he did that weird thing about the bridal shower or bachelorette party at a baseball game.
He can bite me. He can bite me real hard. And yet, even with all of that, I would still take him and the incredible anger that he inspires in me over Tim fucking McCarver on my television speaking to me ever again.
Well, I hadn't heard Tim McCarver's voice in a long time until I started watching this broadcast. And yeah, just hearing him, I was like, this is but a taste of what we can expect moving forward for the rest of this series. I think, to be fair, his point was that he didn't think the Phillies could win a close game, but he thought they could win a game where both teams were scoring. Why he felt the need to cite the specific scores of 11-7 or 8-5, as though people couldn't imagine what higher numbers are, I don't know.
Were those words not enough? We're saying the words, I think they won't be able to win a close game. They should, you know, they need to score a lot more runs. He could have ended it right there.
And the best part of that is that this was a close game that the Phillies won. So he wasn't even correct about that. Game one went into extra innings. This was good baseball. This was a very good, fun baseball game to be at. Obviously, if the Phillies had lost, that would have taken a hit. But there was an outfield assist when Ron Gant threw out Milt Thompson at the plate. There was a walk-off hit for the Phillies, which we'll obviously get to. Not too many of the Phillies came through. Every one of the Phillies came through at some point, but not many of them came through more than once. Pete Incaviglia went 2-for-4. Wes Chamberlain went 2-for-3. Wes Chamberlain getting the start in right field. Again, we've talked about this a bunch of times this season, but the amount of platoons on this team, I mean, they really were. They're probably, if we're going to talk in cliches, then I don't know, man. The Phillies might be, in so many ways, the most blue-collar baseball team of all time. Somebody said once the 2010 Phillies losing to the 2010 Giants in the playoffs. Well, now we know how the 93 Braves felt. And I think that's not an accurate description of that situation. But, man, this team, like, it really felt like they were duct-taped together at certain points. And they still managed to come through. But but hit a ton of doubles. Lenny Dykstra hit a double. Wes Chamberlain hit a double. Dave Hollins hit a double. John Kruk hit a double. And Kim Batiste hit a double, which really, you know, catches you off guard, considering the fact that they were facing a 23-year-old Steve Avery, which is just such a scary concept for those guys to, like, not only those guys all being on the same rotation, but that they were young once and just at the beginning of their careers. The thing about Avery,
they were young once.
The thing about Avery is that this was really his last, like, really good season. 91 to 93 were kind of his most effective years. He finished sixth in Cy Young voting in 91 when he was 21 years old. He had a 3.38 ERA and, you know, was a good young starter for the Braves. In 1992, he led the league in games started with 35 and a 3.20 ERA all season long. Like, that's also, you know, something you want to see in your 22-year-old starter. And in the 93, he made his only All-Star appearance at 23 years old. And then after that, you know, it fell apart for him. He finished his career. He never again had an ERA below 4 at this point. And in 1997, 98, 99, late 90s, he couldn't get it under 5. He eventually tried to make a comeback when he was 33 years old with the Tigers in 2003. But, you know, obviously that didn't work out. But this was, yeah, this was kind of the last great baseball Steve Avery would pitch. And the Phillies managed to get to him, which was, again, in a close scoring game. A little surprising, at least to Tim McCarver, you could say. But, you know, this is what we were looking at. So yeah, the Phillies are taking on young, terrifying one of the Braves starters. Curt Schilling got the ball for the Phillies, and he wound up going 8 innings and he allowed 7 hits, 2 earned runs, 10 strikeouts, and that wound up being, like, you know, pretty crucial, keeping the Braves bats silent as they were for the first half. One matchup that people really were talking about were the leadoff guys for both teams, and that's Otis Nixon and Lenny Dykstra, both of whom wound up having very troubled lives outside of baseball when their careers ended. We all know Lenny Dykstra was on the verge of going to prison. I don't know what Otis Nixon is doing currently, but Trevor and I did an episode of The Dirty Inning that featured Otis Nixon. I believe it was last year. And at the point that we were recording the episode, Otis Nixon was actively missing. And he was, no one knew where he was. So he is also having some, he's been through some drug issues as well. But
oh gosh, I think so. I remember
at the time, yeah, though, that was a matchup people wanted to see. They considered crucial to both teams' success. Otis Nixon went 2-for-4 during this game, and obviously he was a threat on the base paths as well. He doubled off Curt Schilling, and he didn't. They managed to keep him from scoring, which was kind of the crucial part. But yeah, Schilling threw 8 solid innings, kept the Braves mostly off the board. They scored twice off of him. But this game really came down to the last at bat, which we'll get to in a minute. But John Kruk had an RBI ground out in the bottom of the first off Steve Avery after Dykstra had doubled and Mariano Duncan had singled, and that knocked in the first run of the game. Then Dave Hollins hit into a double play. So the Phillies were up 1-0, which obviously wasn't going to be enough. Otis Nixon's double off Curt Schilling in the third wound up scoring Steve Avery, who had hit a double off Curt Schilling one batter before. So a couple of anomalies in this game. That tied it up at 1-1. Dave Justice then hit a sac fly off Curt Schilling in the top of the fourth, after Schilling had allowed the first two runners to reach on a walk and a single. It was Ron Gant and Fred McGriff. But he managed to wriggle out of trouble that inning as well. So they were only down 2-1 when Pete Incaviglia hit a home run off Steve Avery the next inning, and now it's 2-2. It was Pete Incaviglia at the plate again when Steve Avery, he had allowed a walk to John Kruk, a double to Dave Hollins, and then they intentionally walked Darren Dalton, which was probably smart, but that loaded the bases for Pete Incaviglia, and Avery uncorked a wild pitch that allowed Kruk to score, and then the Phillies didn't do anything else offensively that inning, so they were only up 3-2, and even though they had the bases loaded with one out. So that led it to Otis Nixon coming through again. He hit a RBI ground out. But listen, and that, I'm mentioning this because think all this offense, like the Braves were supposed to have this great offense. It didn't kick into gear until the second half of the season. The Phillies, again, as Tim McCarver was trying to say before the game, have this high powered offense that if they have a good start from their pitcher, you know, they'll be able to, well, if they don't have a good start from their pitcher, they'll be able to neutralize any offensive threat because at any moment they could break off 8, 9, 10 runs and come out safe. But all the runs in this game, Liz, you know, they're being scored because, I mean, Otis Nixon's ground out happened because Mark Lemke of the Braves reached on an error by Kevin Stocker at shortstop. And, yeah, before that, it was a wild pitch. Before that, it was a sac fly. Before that, the pitcher had managed to hit a double and then get knocked in. Like, a lot of it wasn't, Titanic home run bashing baseball. And I don't know, is that the kind of playoff game you want to see, or do you want to see two offenses go nuts on each other?
I don't know. It's a good question because the recent Yankees Red Sox game 4 in the ALDS was really good. It was low scoring. The Yankees almost came back at the end. I mean, that's the good thing about a low scoring game is that there's always the threat that someone could come back at any moment and, you know, remember how to hit a baseball. But you know, offense is fun. I mean, that's, who can argue with that? Offense is super duper fun.
I mean, I'm not going to argue with you.
So the, there's no answer there. I gave you nothing.
You know what else is fun, Liz? The new Bigfoot pizza from Pizza Hut. The biggest pizza available.
Oh, my God. The Bigfoot pizza.
Ah! Liz, what's your favorite Bigfoot pizza memory?
Oh, God. I don't know if I have. Oh, I think we had it at a party. We might have had it at like a, you know, a classmate's party that they had at the local.
You're damn
line.
Right.
They called in some Bigfoot pizza. We all went swimming in the pool, and then we changed and went upstairs to the party room, which was also a room that I would go into most days after school for after school care when we were going to the Y, and we had a Bigfoot pizza. It was a big deal.
It was
deal.
A big deal. I mean, that's why that pizza existed, so a kid could see it on the commercial and be like, I want that for my birthday. And the parents to be like, well, okay, yeah, I mean, that's the best way to feed 30 kids at a bowling alley. So, yeah, we'll definitely be grabbing one of those. The pieces were all tiny little squares, so that was, misleading, I would say.
Like gross Midwestern pizza.
Yeah, just jam a whole piece in your mouth. Like at in grade school when they would be like, everyone can have two pieces, and you'd get your two pieces, and it was clearly one piece cut in half. And you're like, I'm not an idiot. I know what's going on here.
You're making me think I can have more, but it's the same.
Yeah, this is like the first propaganda I'm getting where I'm being told, oh, no, this is what you want. No, it's not. I am aware of the size and the parameters of pizza receiving. Come on. Anyway, so this game comes down to the 10th inning. Game goes into extras after the Otis Nixon ground out that allows Mitch Williams had come into the game to replace Curt Schilling, and Kent Merker had replaced Steve Avery, both of which happened later in the game. Both guys were left in the game pretty late. Steve Avery gave the Braves 6 innings, and Curt Schilling gave the Phillies 8. So Kent Merker had come in to replace Avery, and then Mitch Williams was brought in to replace Schilling. And, fucking stunner that it's Mitch Williams who isn't able to hold up a one-run lead. In the top of the ninth, it's 3-2. Williams allows a leadoff walk, and then Mark Lemke reached on the error, which then Rafael Belliard hit a sacrifice bunt that allowed the two runners in scoring position. And that's when Otis Nixon's ground out scored the tying run, of course. So then Mitch Williams walks the next batter as well because he was useless. And then fortunately struck out Ron Gant. So the game's only tied. Phillies go down 1-2-3 in the bottom of the ninth. So the game goes into extras. Mitch Williams is back on the mound because that's just the kind of baseball we're playing in 1993. He again gets into a little bit of trouble. There's two outs, but he allows a single to Terry Pendleton, a double to Greg Olson. No run score, however. Pendleton gets stopped at third base because he's Terry Pendleton. He's a tank. He's not you're not chancing it, especially with two outs. But fortunately, Mitch Williams manages to strike out Tony Tarasco and neutralize the threat. So that brought the Phillies their chance in the bottom of the 10th. Mariano Duncan grounds out. John Kruk doubles. And that brings to the plate Kim Batiste. Liz, Kim Batiste, how about him? Any thoughts?
I have no thoughts.
I can recall.
None. Kim Batiste. Other than I'm sure there was a lot of teasing.
I remember Kim Batiste. He was one of their bench guys who, on a team like this, of course, wound up winning the game for them a couple of times. When Dave Hollins got hurt earlier in the season, Kim Batiste came in at one point to play third base. And I think he hit a walk-off hit in a game like that too. But the thing was, he was brought in because as a defensive replacement. So the fact that he had timely hitting at all at any point during the season was surprising for the little New Orleans native that the Phillies had acquired. He's 50 years old now, which is hilarious to me to think about all these guys. But in 1993, he was 25 years old. He had never really played on too many teams at all. In 91 he played in 10 games for the Phillies. In 92 he played in 44 games for the Phillies, and of course this year with the Phillies he managed to get into almost half the game, 79, and he'd hit 282, which is phenomenal. Like, for a bench player, guy who's supposed to be a defensive specialist, if he's doing his job on defense and hitting 282 even in just half your games, that's That's a contributor. That's a guy. He never had a season like again. He never almost didn't have a season again. He did play for the Phillies again in 94, but obviously that season was marred by the strike shortened year. He only made it into 64 games. Then he showed up with the Giants in 96. But other than that, he just, he didn't have a place on a major league roster anymore at that point. That's exactly the kind of guys who were, you know, on the Phillies in 1993. But he comes up facing Braves reliever Greg McMichael. And on a 1-2 pitch, the fourth pitch of the at-bat, he manages to hit a ground ball, a double to left field that scores John Kruk. And the Phillies managed to win the game in a walk-off. And exactly the way Tim McCarver believed they were going to be unable to win the game. So, yeah, I mean, honestly, you're right that you can't downplay offense. You can't hate an offensive game in the playoffs. And obviously, if the Phillies had won that game in the World Series that they lost 15-14, that would have been a pretty fun game. If that game had happened in the regular season, it'd be a pretty fun game to watch. But yeah, the walk-off win in the playoffs, that's tough to beat. And this one especially, like, Kim Batiste comes up and hits a ground ball, not just like to the left side. He has to hit it past the third, between the third baseman and the foul line. Like, it's one of those. It's this bouncing ground ball. Third baseman comes in to dive for it, and if he gets it, you know, he's going to be able to potentially throw him out or at least keep the run from scoring. But the ball gets past him, and it's skipping down the AstroTurf as if it's like McAdam, and gets all the way to the corner. And Larry Bowa is like freaking out, waving his arm. He's waving in John Kruk, who's like, you know, a base runner in this capacity. The place is going crazy, but the ball's in the corner. Like, everyone knows this game is over, including Larry Bowa, who, as soon as John Kruk touches third base, Larry Bowa stops windmilling and has just turned around and is facing the dugout and is just cheering. Like, he's celebrating. The game is not over, but he's just like, okay, it's over. He's jumping up and down, hands in the air, and yeah, and it's over. Place is going nuts. 62,000 people going crazy. So that's how the Phillies started the playoffs in 1993. We don't really need to talk about game two that much because, I don't know, have you looked at, do you know what the score is of game two of the 1993 NLCS, Liz?
I do not.
The score was 14-3. And the Phillies did not come out on top in this one. Tommy Green got absolutely shelled. He was pulled before the end of the third inning. The Braves put six runs up on him in the third inning. It was 8-0 at that point. Like, we would have to do a dirty inning episode on this one because of how brutal it is. Otis Nixon, they had singled off him to start the inning. They managed to catch Otis Nixon stealing, which was kind of clutch, but then he gave up a home run to Jeff Blauser, and then Tommy Green just starts bleeding base runners. It's a double to Ron Gant, a single to Fred McGriff. Feels like that sequence happened a lot during these playoffs. He walks David Justice. Terry Pendleton hits an RBI single. Damon Berryhill hits a three-run home run. At this point, the Phillies are down 8-0. Like, after a huge win like that the night before, I'm not even seeing evidence that this happened, but it's not crazy to think about this team being like, we won that one playoff game, and like getting completely wrecked and coming out the next day and being like, oh crap, we have to play another one. Actually, I think the way this team talks about itself and the way they took the game seriously, that probably did not happen. But obviously, there were two forms of this team, and one of them would certainly do that. But in any case, Ben Rivera came in, and he was not known necessarily for keeping runners off the base paths for a lot of the year. But he managed to keep the Braves off the board, but he also, his appearance signified that this was now a bullpen game. So Ben Rivera comes out, Roger Mason comes in, 1-2-3 inning. He's got to pitch two innings. He keeps the Braves off the board. Then David West comes in, and that's where more trouble starts. He gives up a bunch of runs. Larry Anderson comes in for the top of the ninth, and the Phillies are down 13-2. And I mean, you want to talk about an air being out of the stadium. That game sucks to lose NLCS game at home. I mean, how much credence do you put to the idea that, like, if you start a playoff series and you've got those two games at home, if you're the away team, you absolutely have to win one of those games, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes. How much there's more for me to say.
Yeah. I mean, there's no, and if, I remember giving up games like that when the Phillies were playing in the playoffs regularly, and it was just like, oh crap, yeah, that this is at least now going to be interesting. The difference between being up two games to none and then going on the road and then 1-1 is like so astronomically different, and especially getting shelled like that. So you want to talk about like an emotional high and then an emotional low? I mean, Liz, like, can you imagine like the emotional deficit between a thrilling extra inning walk-off win one night and then getting absolutely blown out of the water with one of your best starters on the mound the following night?
I mean, it's almost exactly, if you reverse them, it's almost exactly like the Yankees and the Red Sox and the ALDS, yes. Right? The Yankees got shellacked for, they have 54 years, 54 separate seasons, I think, of postseason history, of playoff history. That was their worst and most lopsided loss out of all of them.
What an awesome
and moment. I know. And then the next night, they got, you know, after that shellacking, they got kicked to the curb.
Yeah.
They did at least win one game.
Forever. The New York Yankees. They will. I wrote something about this that's going to come up tomorrow for Baseball Perspectives, but it is so good for baseball when the Yankees get eliminated. Not just when they lose in the playoffs or get embarrassed in the playoffs, but when they get eliminated, it's such a good, like, obviously Yankees fans don't like it, but for everyone else who isn't a Yankees fan, it is such a good moment to watch them lose and be sad and like look human, because they've just been built up as this like titanic franchise of heroes, you know, of baseball's greatest heroes all assembled into what, I mean, that, look at that Bob Nightingale tweet earlier this week, where he was talking about how the Red Sox were underdogs and had to come back against the Yankees. Like, the Red Sox won 108 games this year. The Yankees.
Is there gas leak in his house?
Much less superior than the Red Sox. The Red Sox are everyone is an underdog to the Red Sox in these playoffs. Everyone has been, and everyone will be, because they had a phenomenal regular season, the best regular season we've seen in years. Like, that was absurd that they would be an underdog to anyone.
That's bonkers. I mean, we're going to diverge for just a second, because I wanted to mention this earlier, because the playoffs, you know, people think the playoffs are connected to the regular season, and in a sense they are, because you have to get through the regular season to get there. But once you get there, everything is erased. You might as well have won. You have won 0 games. Everyone has won 0 games at the start. You've not won 108. You've won nothing. And so, you know, I can sort of see where he's coming from, because if you look at it purely on a man-to-man basis, I'm assuming he's looking literally only at, you know, like Aaron Judge and maybe D.D. Gregorius. I can't remember if he had been doing really well. You know, Luke Voit, who's like a lump of unbreakable bread dough wearing a hat. You know, Giancarlo Stanton, he's looking at them and being like, how could the Red Sox with their team of, you know, scrappy homegrown first rounders beat the Yankees behemoth? Like, just shut up. Just shut up. I can't. I've heard nothing, but Bob is such a nice guy. I've heard so many things about how Bob is a nice guy, but man, I just wish he would stop tweeting. No more tweeting. Well, I guess it's not entirely true, because his tweets do bring me pleasure.
It is certainly confusing. It seems like there's a different reality that he's dictating his tweets from occasionally.
Like I said, a home with a constant gas leak.
In any case, yeah, the Phillies got absolutely shellacked in game two after a walk-off win. Part of that is because Greg Maddux, the Braves' prized free agency acquisition that year, started that game and absolutely pitched the living hell out of it. He wound up going 7 innings, gave up 5 hits and 3 walks, 2 earned runs, and that was plenty. He got the Braves used a couple of relievers. They used their stoic closer, Mark Wahlers, to close out the game. Lenny Dykstra actually managed to hit a home run off him, but you want to talk about garbage time? Good Lord. So the Phillies bullpen had their middle relief crew had really come through for them in the past season, which is also something we've talked about in 1993, that's a part of your team that's supposed to be bad. That's why they have the jobs they have, yet they leaned on them enough during the regular season. Couldn't come through in the postseason, unfortunately. Bobby Thigpen allowed a run. Ben Rivera allowed a run. David West allowed three runs. Larry Anderson allowed a run. Like, this was it was brutal. It was a brutal loss. And spirits could not have been extremely high going into the next game of the series, which we will talk about on the next episode of Continued Success. We'll get through the NLCS. Well, we'll talk about probably one after the next episode. Next episode, we'll go back to the 2008 season, close out the NLDS. And then for the following episode, we'll talk about the rest of this series. And then hopefully we'll get through the rest of the postseason before the end of the actual postseason. And if we don't, people, you'll just have more podcasts to listen to about good times in Phillies baseball. So nothing to complain about over here. Liz, do you have any more parting thoughts before we close out another fantastic episode of Continued Success?
Other than watch the, enjoy what little baseball we have left. Enjoy that the Yankees aren't in it. And if you have a heart or a brain, root for the Astros to be eliminated or alternately launched into the sun. Aside from that, like, another the other three teams could win and I would not care.
Another grim assessment from our in-house emo rocker, Liz Rocher.
Shut up, Astros.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you for listening to Continued Success. Please subscribe and download any of the podcasts of the members of the Good Fight podcast family, and subscribe to the Hidden Season Patreon if you feel you need bonus content on your Philadelphia Phillies throughout the week. But we will talk to you more about all the podcasts we're on and the 2008 Phillies next time on Continued Success.
I'm Michael Kist of Bleeding Green Nation, and I invite you, gentle listener, to join us for the best analysis of the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles in the business. BGN Radio provides you with the most informative preview shows, and the Kist and Solak show dives deep into all the scheme and X and O details you could ever want. Plus discussions with the industry's brightest minds, including former NFL players, and press conferences from the Eagles coaching staff to keep you up to date and informed every step of the way. Subscribe to Bleeding Green Nation today. Fly, Eagles, fly.